Hello, my name is Donovan Bigelow, and these are going to be two lectures on evolutionary psychology. And right off the bat, I have to acknowledge that evolutionary psychology has been a problem since Darwin. It has caused people frustration and fear and anger. It's very controversial, and with some very significant changes in the last just 20 or 25 years, it remains controversial. The first thing I have to address is the question of religion. Even in Darwin's day, people realized that the idea of evolution ran counter to many people's beliefs in God and in creationism. And today, I think it's even sort of more controversial because while that element of evolutionary psychology is still alive, there is now controversy on the other side as well. People who I think can be under the heading of social constructivists, people who think that we are what we are because of the way our culture is or the way we learn or our experience, our environments. Those kind of folks are also troubled by evolutionary theory because it implies some kind of determinism, some sort of biological determinism, as if we're locked in concrete by our genetics and we can't do anything and environment doesn't matter. So let me address both of those concerns right up front. In the modern evolutionary theory, which is what I want to focus on, this is not your granddaddy's Darwinism. We've come a long way and there's been many, many developments, primarily in the field of genetics, but also in the field of evolutionary psychology itself since the 70s. The religious question first. I believe that the vast majority of evolutionary psychologists do not need to, I don't think they even want to, address the question of origins, whether God put us here or whether we evolved from lesser species. For the purposes of evolutionary psychology, at least, that question doesn't matter and we don't have to address it. The bottom line here is that evolutionary psychology, its study, focusing on it, discussing it, need not in any way threaten anyone's religious beliefs. I think it's fair to say that most of the most mindful evolutionary psychologists take the position that however we started, however we got here, then we must assume that if we evolve from lesser species, then the evolutionary dynamics that we're going to talk about today are in play, were in play before, are still in play, and lent us the characteristics that we have as a species. If God put us here, the assumption is he or she or it, however you characterize it, must have put us here with the ability to survive differing environments and different conditions. So put us here, perhaps, with evolutionary tendencies that will allow us to adapt and survive. Why wouldn't he? How could he not? So just to take that off the table, and I had a class a couple of years ago where a woman missed this first part of the lecture, and when she heard the second part without this sort of disclaimer, she got up and stormed out of the class and was deeply offended that somehow I was teaching atheistic theories that were quite disturbing to her. And I assure everyone that that is not the case, that we do not need to address that question here. There is nothing in evolutionary psychology that need contradict anyone's religious beliefs. One of the things that make it hard to understand evolutionary psychology, besides some predispositions against it, is the idea that we look at the human from a very different perspective, from the genetic perspective. And this is absolutely central. If you don't get this, then the whole field seems confusing and frustrating. Most people, because we're individuals, walk around thinking about being human from the perspective of an individual. It's normal. There's hardly any reason not to do it any other way. Unfortunately, if you want to learn evolutionary psychology, you have to look at it from a gene's eye view, from the perspective of genetics, and most importantly, from the perspective of evolutionary time. So those two things. We're looking at it from the perspective of genetics. How do genes evolve? How do humans evolve? Because we are primarily a construct out of genetic material, how does that evolve over geologic time? Genetics change very slowly, tens of thousands of years potentially. There is an argument that under certain circumstances, mutations might happen relatively rapidly across the population, but by and large, most people agree that our society now is changing faster than our genetics can possibly keep up. On that, virtually everyone agrees. So we have to keep in mind that we're talking about human populations on a large bell curve over geologic time. If you can do that, then a lot of this will make a lot more sense. One of the objections, when we get into the more into the specifics, I have students all the time say, well, I don't feel that way, so evolutionary theory must be wrong. And I'm suggesting that there is a level of analysis problem. If you look at it as a statistic, a bell curve of human populations over time, then these ideas make perfect sense. And there may be individuals where these things don't fit, but that's the bell curve idea. There are always outliers in every human population. And so I want to sort of take it to a higher level of abstraction, a higher level of analysis. Genetics over geologic time, not individuals. Basically, this is statistics in some ways, not therapy for individuals. The other thing that I think is exciting about evolutionary psychology now is that although I'm not going to say that any particular evolutionary psychologist has claimed that evolutionary psychology is the new primary theory, there's hints that it's heading in that direction, that the assumption is that evolutionary psychology represents at least the possibility of a grand synthesis of drive and relational psychologies, sociology, ethology. A variety of fields seem to be all subsumed under evolutionary psychology. It's very exciting that we have a way, perhaps, to explain human behavior, explain human behavior across the spectrum: love, hate, families, nation states, tribes, war, technology development, territoriality. There are very few psychologies who at least have the potential for explaining virtually everything about human behavior, behavior that we all recognize is incredibly complex. Again, a potential. The field is still relatively young. Most of the great evolutionary psychology innovations didn't start percolating till the 1970s. A vast gap between Darwin, then the discovery of genetics in the last century, and then a half a dozen theorists taking those developments, those sequential developments, into a new way of thinking about human behavior. One of the other challenges that make evolutionary psychology hard for some people to take, especially today in the West, is that we have a bit of an ideology, multiculturalism, questions of diversity. This has been quite important in the last 20 or 30 years, and people believe passionately about the value of multiculturalism. Evolutionary psychology will, to some degree, challenge that, and in good ways and potentially destructive ways, frankly. The idea here is that, especially with the advent of the Human Genome Project, the ability for us to map the human genetics, the human genetic code, what we find is that we are all more human than otherwise, that the differences between races, the differences between cultures, are almost irrelevant, are at best superficial, stylistic, aesthetic, and that the good news, one of the little bits of good news that I think evolutionary psychologists simply stumbled on, was the idea that evolutionary psychology, to me, seems like the final refutation of racism. That the differences between the races are quite literally no more than skin deep, and that given the discovery of genetics, we can now prove to a scientific certainty that the variations among the tribes, the races, the cultures are as completely irrelevant as you can imagine. There, and one extra, perhaps, sort of nail in the coffin of racialist theories is the idea from genetics, that there's no such thing as group characteristics. Genetics happen individually. Male, female, mate, the 23 pairs of chromosomes in each come together to form a human with 46 pairs of chromosomes, and they are a unique mix of those two sets. We do not pass on genetics to the group. We pass on genetics to an individual. Therefore, there aren't any genetics-based racial categories, attributes, that we can identify. It becomes a way to sort of scientifically refute prejudice. This feels to me like not a small advantage to studying evolutionary psychology. Another disturbing thing about evolutionary psychology is that recognizing that human history 99.999% of human history on this planet, we were all in the same situation. Humans lived, whether it was in Africa, Asia, Europe, or wherever, in small, hard to tell, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, member small tribal groups, somewhat nomadic, but generally staying in the same area, hunter-gatherer scavengers, and that is how we evolved. The problem now is, and this is a fascinating area of study, we don't know why civilization exploded 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago. Everyone's talking about it in evolutionary psychology, but no one's got any clear idea of exactly how and why that happened. Sprang up not just in one place, but several places all over the world. We are now facing a civilization that's so different from our evolved background that it seems to be the source of a great deal of our troubles. We are a hunter-gatherer, scavenger, Cro-Magnon ancestor who literally throughout virtually the entire history of our existence on this planet lived a very particular lifestyle, adapted to that lifestyle. The genetic changes that happened that were allowed some of them to survive better than others were adaptive to that environment and that environment alone. And Freud recognized this in 1932 when he wrote a book called Civilization and Its Discontents. The idea that this amazingly complex civilization that we have, civilizations that we have, the dynamic is the same all over the world, simply no longer fits very well our biological predispositions. And there is the source of a tremendous amount of conflict. We'll sort the details of that out as we go through. A thinker named Thomas Malthus, 200 or 300 years ago, came up with the idea of competition among species. His idea was that populations grow faster than resources can be made to satisfy everyone's needs. So that, and this strikes many modern Westerners as very difficult to take. Human experience on this planet is inevitably riven with conflict, with competition, unforgiving, unrelenting competition. This strikes directly at most of our cherished Western religious and ethical values. And it also may explain why we so rarely actually live up to our ethical values. We are hardwired in some ways to compete. And even if we could meet our material needs, the competition for superior mates, the competition for superior territory, seems to the evolutionary psychologist, in large part quite hardwired, to the point where the question of human nature comes up. Again, a controversial idea. The evolutionary psychologists seem to be quite clear about this, that if you look back at history, it is very hard to deny that humans have a certain way of doing things that's been pretty consistent across cultures and across recorded time. And so they're going to suggest that although we have some adaptivity, and I'll get to that later, they do suggest that there are fundamentals. Human nature does exist. The things that the founding fathers of the United States put in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Their theory was around the question of human nature, which they saw as quite problematic and needed a limited government of separation of powers to make sure that our human nature was contained, controlled, wasn't allowed to get out of control, would not allow a single individual or small group to dominate politically, dominate in terms of power. So I think there's, even in our country, there's a trend going back recognizing, at the very least, the complicated nature of human nature and the sort of unpleasant reality that humans are an intensely competitive lot. But we have to be a little more sophisticated about that. It's not just competition. I think it's very clear to most of us in terms of common sense that males are competitive by and large. And I don't think too many people would argue the contrary. Are females competitive? And sort of a joke I've said for years is that the most, not just competitive, but aggressively so. Are women competitive? Are women aggressive? And one of the little jokes I've had that most women in the class nod their head knowingly when I say this is the most vicious animal on the planet is an angry eighth grade girl. There's some truth to that. Maybe one of the things that evolutionary psychology does is it lends some scientific bedrock to a lot of the things that we just know as common sense. So men are competitive, women are competitive, but there's an additional element here. Women's selective preferences, what they want in a man, what they want in a partner, that seems to be based on biology in a way that's not the same for a man who has a different biology. And this goes back to who has the babies. I think this is one of the key insights in evolutionary psychology. The biological differences from the act of sexual reproduction, the fact, the biological fact. And if you really want to complain about evolutionary psychology, the evolutionary psychologist, I think, would say, go talk to God or Darwin, because it is a biological fact that men and women have different roles in procreation. The fact that a woman carries the child makes her vulnerable, especially toward the end of the term of the pregnancy. The needs, evolutionarily speaking, again, over geologic time, the needs of women who were pregnant and needed to be protected and fed and cared for, and the needs of men who needed to be chosen by women who were perhaps superior. How do you show your superiority? You conquer territory. You're a good hunter. You protect the territory of the tribe or the clan. You compete with other men. So competition among men to show the women in the tribe who was superior is the oldest story in humanity. And really, are we that much different today? Why do we have the Olympics? What are the Olympics? Let me throw this out right now. Take a look at our sports. It is not an accident, folks. It is not a coincidence that our most popular sports, football, basketball, hockey, soccer, what are they? One tribe of hunters charging into the territory of another tribe, always with different colors on, right, different face paint on, and controlling the other side's territory, control, imposing their will. Oh, and by the way, what are those cheerleaders doing along the side? Reminding the men what they're fighting for. It cannot be a coincidence that all of our cultural sports, including the Olympics, which if you look at the specifics of the events, all of them, virtually, okay, one or two exceptions, but virtually all of Olympic events seem to show a physical prowess that is directly related to the conquest of territory, to hunting, to gathering, to tribal dynamics. It seems unmistakable to the evolutionary psychologist and seems like evidence of a residual tendency in us to live through our adaptive genetic potentials. Even in a complex postmodern Western civilization, we still, at bottom, engage in behaviors that look remarkably tribal. One more shift in perspective. We think of ourselves as individuals, mostly, okay, always in a particular culture, particular tribal family dynamic. Freud, in 1905, wrote a book called Three Essays on Sexuality, and it shocked the Western world, and he suggested that sexuality was central to our existence, that it really was the motivating factor. Among all motivating factors, it was about sexuality. It wasn't until he was 72 years old that he recognized the importance of aggression in support of sexuality, but he eventually got it right, combining those two. What Freud's sort of intuitive genius came to is exactly the same conclusion the evolutionary psychologists have come to recently, that we are sexualized creatures. We are sexualized creatures from our head to our toes. And of course we are, because the ones who were that way over evolutionary time had more success in mating. Their genes with those tendencies tended to be passed down to the next generation and the next more successfully than the ones who were a bit lackadaisical about sexuality. So the simple truth is, in terms of sex and aggression as biological precursors to our behavior, we had to be the ancestors of the very aggressive ones, the very sexual ones. And I don't think it's a stretch, folks, to ask you to look around your world. How you cannot turn a television on, you cannot go to the movies, you can't walk by a magazine stand without being inundated with sexual and aggressive imagery. It's pervasive. It's universal. It isn't just a moral failure. It isn't just a sign of weakness. It isn't just turpitude. It has to do with living out an evolved tendencies. Now, one of the great innovations in evolutionary psychology in the modern time is that we have adaptive potentials. This is really important. We're not hardwired. We're not biologically determined. Probably the great innovation in modern evolutionary psychology is this idea that we have, and this sounds kind of odd, but go with me, an adaptive, hardwired biology. We're hardwired to be adaptive. That's why humans have survived and have conquered the entire planet. Every type of environment, the Arctic North, the triple canopy jungles in the Congo, there is no place on the planet and there is no other species on the planet that lives in such diverse environments. We somehow, humans developed, or were given by God, this adaptive potential. Now the question is, how fast can we adapt? And the answer is slowly, it appears. We've adapted to civilization, but I think we could argue that we haven't adapted very well to it. Our problems are astonishing. We have taken tribal warfare and made it global. It's disturbing to realize that not just are we now having world wars, but we're having so many of them, we've started to number them. This is, if you step back and think about that for a minute, it's shocking and it's dangerous. And it suggests that evolutionary psychologists might have been onto something, that we're effectively identical creatures to the Cro-Magnon ancestors wandering around the plains of Africa, Asia, and Europe 50,000 years ago, except now we have large caliber weapons and our fingers on nuclear triggers. My hope is that the study of this material might give us access to a way of thinking about what it means to be human that might actually allow us to help solve our problems and not just pretend they aren't there. That's the naive hope, perhaps. Okay, now with all of that as preliminary material, let me get to the nuts and bolts of this. Everyone's heard the phrase, most of us have heard the phrase, natural selection. But that's got some elements to it that we must understand or we won't understand evolutionary psychology at all. If we don't understand these three things, variation, inheritance, and selection, these are the mechanisms of natural selection that have allowed evolution to happen at all. It starts with sexual mating. We have genetics that get mixed and mutations, what the evolutionary psychologists called variations. Genetic mutations, very small most of the time, hardly discernible, might, if they're inheritable, provide a selective advantage in a particular environment. Now, let me break this down. We all know about genetic mutations. I am approximately 6 foot tall. I'm a relatively mesomorphic build. Other people are taller, thinner, different colored hair, different color eyes, different musculatures, different bone structures, different colors. Those variations, while the geneticists are going to argue, are within the species human, provide potentially in a particular environment an advantage. Now, in some ways, the most obvious ones are skin color. If you're African living in the near the equator with blistering sun, over the course of time, a darker pigmented skin is an adaptive advantage. And that's obvious when you imagine bringing someone down from Sweden to wander around the plains of Kenya for 15 minutes. It would be almost deadly. And so people's differences evolve depending on their environment. And the fact that we didn't have transportation technology until very recently meant that changes could happen within small populations in given environments. The obvious examples, how is it in Kenya that I believe the tribe is called, is it the Maasai or the Watusi? They're 6'8", 7 foot tall, an incredibly tall tribe, extended group of tribes actually. How is it that they became that tall? Well, imagine 50, 100, a million years ago, the environment isn't that much different than it was back then. We have what's called lion grass in Kenya. And why is it called lion grass? Let me think. Because there's lions in it. And it's about 5 foot tall. If you're 4 foot eight, you're not going to last very long in the lion grass. So over the course of time, those variations, in this case, variations, a genetic mutation that just coincidentally allowed a child to be just a little bit taller, over the course of time, that slight advantage is statistically significant. And the taller ones survived better than the shorter ones. You throw in a couple of 100,000 years, and you've got 7 feet tall people wandering around the plains of the Serengeti. Now, go 600 miles east, give or take. You end up in the triple canopy jungle of the Congo. What do we have there? Pygmies. 4 foot eight, 4 foot 10. How is it that they evolved? They're in the same continent. They're not that far away from each other. Well, the environment was totally different. You can't be 6 foot, 7 foot tall running around the jungle. Short had an adaptive advantage, a selective advantage. And over the course of time, in these relatively stable tribal populations, the shorter ones in that advantage tended to survive better and pass their genes, their shorter genes, onto their children. So, while we're all the same species, there are variations. Some of those variations are inheritable. If they're not inheritable, they can have no effect on evolution. And the key is that some of those inheritable variations might provide a slight selective advantage. I've got to be careful here. They use the word selective, but that has nothing to do with choice. You've got to get this right. This is a level of analysis problem again. If you think of this part of evolutionary psychology as having anything to do with choice, you're missing the boat. This has to do with advantages in environments over evolutionary times, statistics, tiny variations, changes in the human body that are not noticeable one generation from the other, really. But over the course of time, in these bell curves of statistical populations, make a difference that changes the nature of the species as a whole. So selection here doesn't mean choice. It means a selective advantage in a particular environment. Now, what about those advantages? Advantages over who? And the answer is differential reproductive success relative to others is the advantage. Differential reproductive success. That means, well, in some ways, it's good news for some of us. You don't have to be better looking, taller, stronger, wealthier than Hollywood stars. You just have to be better, wealthier, healthier than the people who you're in competition with locally. Differential reproductive success relative to others. If you are more successful in mating in your area, your genes survive. Evolutionary psychology is about genetic survival, not survival of the individual. This is where, again, level of analysis problem. Keep focused on genetic survival. A new innovation, a new phrase that we have to understand is reproductive fitness. Most people have heard survival of the fittest, a Darwinian idea. We don't think that way anymore. It isn't just about fitness. It isn't just about size and strength. It's about reproductive fitness, which means a new layer of complication, a new layer of sophistication. We have to do two things to survive genetically, if that's the priority here. One is survival, so there is a survival component to it. We have to defend our territory. We have to hunt. We have to kill something to eat. We have to be able to aggressively defend our territory. But then we have to mate. None of the survival counts, evolutionarily speaking, if we don't have the ability to pass our genes on to the next and the next and the next generation. So when the psychologists talk about reproductive fitness, they mean those two elements, and they're equally important. And this is what has made, I think, modern evolutionary psychology so rich, so fruitful, so complicated. Because for the first time, we're really talking very clearly and carefully about mating, about that old question, what women want, what men want, what women want. As kind of a humorous aside here, in the early 30s, Sigmund Freud wrote a letter to a woman analyst, a colleague of his named Marie Bonaparte. And he said to her something like this: "Dear Marie, for 40 years I have studied the human mind, and the one question that has always eluded me is what women want." And I believe that's where they took the title of that recent movie with Mel Gibson, What Women Want. No one, even Freud, even the great Freud, really understood what women want very well. And I love this about evolutionary psychology. They have done, and Dr. David Buss from Texas has been doing research for the last 20 years using astonishingly large research populations from all over the world. 15, 16,000 women, 40,000 women in every continent, every socioeconomic level, every religious group, every ethnic organization or ethnic group. And the results of this research are astonishing. It turns out women everywhere, mostly, statistically, want the same things. And there's a lot of them. Dr. Buss has noticed 10 things that women want. Men only want 3, maybe 2. But everybody knows that. Women's mating choices are complicated. Men's seem, to most of us, fairly simple. That's common sense. That's sort of almost culturally obvious. But the evolutionary psychologists doing rather complicated and thorough research have come up with explanations for exactly why that is. It all goes back to the biological differential between giving birth and giving seed. One more general point, a couple more on evolutionary psychology. Evolution is not tending toward anything. There's a word called teleology, the study of endpoints, the study of goals. And we've got to be very clear that there is no goal in evolution. There is no larger evolutionary consciousness. Carl Jung created this idea of the collective unconscious. The evolutionists would probably dispute that. We don't know what the future holds. Evolutionary psychology has no ability to predict the future, other than recognizing human nature is consistent and predictable, so I guess there's a way of doing that. But evolution has no goal. There is no redemption at the end. There is no vision of where we're heading. Evolution is only concerned first with the genetics and then with the variations, the mutations, if those variations or mutations are inheritable, and if and only if they provide a selective advantage in the particular environment. Then there's a slight change, which over time becomes the norm in that species if it continues to provide an advantage against the other members of that species in that environment. So that's it. In a way, I've made some grand claims for evolutionary psychology, but in a way you could argue that the field itself is rather humble. They don't have a large overarching vision of the future. They are pretty focused on just what's going on in the here and now. Technical note, Mendelian genetics. Darwin and Gregor Mendel, the individual who really sort of pioneered the first genetic studies, even though he didn't understand genetics at the microbiological level, that came later. We now have what's called the modern synthesis, and this is the idea that genetics are transferred in particulars. Chromosomes, genetic strands, are transferred to children in discrete packages, discrete building blocks. Genes aren't merged with other genes. They don't meld together. It's more like shuffling a deck of cards than bleeding colors into each other. The particulate theory of genetic inheritance was necessary in order to recognize the lack of group dynamics. Another thing that evolutionary psychology is very famous for is the use of ethology, the study of animal behavior. Can we extrapolate from animal behavior into humans? Can research on animal, primates primarily, chimpanzees and others, does that give us some insight that's useful in the study of humans? We have to be careful. Humans aren't chimpanzees, but it is, I think, useful to think about these things. We can see evolved tendencies in other animals that seem to reflect something about the way we do things. It's a useful study as long as we don't go too far with it. Another idea fostered by a researcher named Hamilton, he came up with this idea of inclusive fitness. And this is where evolutionary psychology starts getting a little complicated. It isn't just about individual survival. It's about the family. It's about the group. and that we have relationships where, within which, working together, we can survive and mate better than we can on our own. We are a herd species. We evolved in the context of tribal organizations. We are not like tigers. We're more like lions. We're more like wolves. We're a tribal herd species. We don't do well on our own. Solitary confinement is punishment. Very few, and maybe there's a few of you out there who are at the ends of the bell curve, who find being alone a good thing. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But it seems quite clearly that that's the exception that proves the rule again. So we have to think about evolution in terms of family structure, in terms of group structure. This is one of the times, again, where evolutionary psychology sort of lends credence to common sense. Blood is thicker than water. We all know that we would defend our immediate family, most of us, over defending complete strangers. This explains why. We're, in fact, hardwired. We're hardwired to defend our relatives. Why? Genetically. They have our genes. They have lots of our genes. You may have some conflict with your brother, but he's got half of your genes, so push come to shove, you will support him over a complete stranger. What this does is it flies in the face of our Western values of altruism. The evolutionary psychologists are suggesting that there's no such thing as altruism, that we will do a lot for other people, but they tend to be related to us in some direct way, and that the farther away we get from direct blood relations, the less generous we are. The research on this has been clear as a bell. And yes, there are Mother Teresa's out there who sacrificed their lives for complete strangers on different continents than they were born on. But again, it feels like that's the very edge of the bell curve. That's the statistical anomaly. That's the rare exception. Mother Teresa was declared a saint. There aren't that many saints out there. The vast majority of us recognize that blood is thicker than water, and evolution gives us an explanation for why exactly that is. So we've already discussed theories by a guy named Williams. Group selection is denied. Only individual transfer of genetic material. The idea of reciprocal altruism, which, the old saying, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Nobody in that situation is being altruistic, but we're being mutually cooperative, and we can both survive better if we do that. Rephrase this one. Differential parental investment equals gender conflict. Part of the disturbing thing that evolutionary psychology raises, and it doesn't raise this, it notices it and tries to explain it. There's gender conflict. Men and women, the war between the sexes has been going on for a long time. Evolution theory has a way of explaining why that is, and if you know what the problem is, if you know why it's a problem, I think you're in much better position to try to fix the problem. If you pretend it's just because men are pigs and they need better education, if that's not really the problem, then those kind of political policies don't actually solve very much, and in fact, can quite frankly make the situation much worse. So we'll get to the gender conflict thing a little bit later. In addition, it also seems clear that this has the possibility, at least, of explaining sibling rivalry. Though we understand now inclusive fitness and the idea that we will sacrifice for our blood relatives, everyone knows that siblings have a great deal of conflict. And within the family, they are still competing with each other for the resources of the parents. That's where that conflict comes from. In a conflict with outside members, the brothers, sisters will pull together, aunts, uncles, cousins will pull together. Clan rivalry goes back a long way. But within that unified front against outsiders, there's internal dissent, internal conflict. And so in a way, if you look at it genetically, you see that there's no conflict in the theory. It makes sense in what seems like a conflict. I'm willing to sacrifice for my brothers, but we're fighting each other tooth, fang, and claw sometimes. From the perspective of evolutionary psychology, that makes perfect sense. So again, we have perhaps a new synthesis. We have a field, relatively new evolutionary psychology, Darwin and evolution have been around for 200 years, but a new way of thinking about synthesizing a variety of disciplines, culture, religion, ethics, even aesthetics. What is beautiful? What is beautiful? It depends on mating preferences. What is beautiful to men is what reflects the potential for childbearing. What is beautiful to women often represents a man able to defend territory and provide resources. It isn't an accident, or it isn't entirely culturally determined what we find beautiful. This has, if we wrap our minds around this, this has ramifications in almost every aspect of our life. And again, I want to make sure that everyone understands that evolutionary psychology is not claiming that somehow human behavior is genetically determined nor unchangeable. Clearly, there is an adaptive mechanism that has evolved. So it's that middle ground. We are not socially constructed entirely. It matters what our environment's like? Absolutely. But you can't change human nature. And within a particular environment, those natural tendencies that were the natural tendencies of humans for the last million years will inevitably come out and have an effect above and beyond the education or culture or values of a particular place and time. So, adaptive. We're not genetically determined, and we're not subject to complete social construction. In a way, it feels quite balanced that we can change, we can adapt to new environments and new problems. We can go to the moon and back. It seems clear to me that fact, the fact that we could go to the moon several times and come back safely, means that we must be able to adapt, that we have some flexibility. And the evolutionary psychologists suggest that it's a hardwired adaptivity. A strange concept, but I think it's central to understanding evolutionary theory generally. Okay, I've heard two strong objections to evolutionary psychology. The first is, well, why do we die so young as a species? Historically, it seems clear that most people live to 30, 35. In the traditional societies, that's very old. Most people now can live 70, 80, 90 years, but still, that's very young. And if evolution worked, if it was really true, then why wouldn't we have evolved? Variation, inheritance, selection, the engine of natural selection, why wouldn't we have evolved to live 200 years, 300 years, 400 years, whatever? And the second thing is suicide. Well, evolutionary psychology can't be right because people commit suicide. So let me address both those things. In terms of the aging, remember what it's about. Genetic competition, not the competition of an individual. Just because I live to be 200 doesn't mean that genetically I will inevitably have superior genetics. The man and or woman who acquire superior mates through hard work, who burn themselves out in effort, acquire the resources, acquire the superior mating, superior mates that allow them to pass superior genes on. I ask this question: why is it in every culture in the world, without exception, men die younger than women? Women outlive men everywhere, all the time. Go to an old folks' home today. What do you see? Vast majority of women and a couple of very happy old men. But the idea, that has to be explained. And in class one day I asked, why is it that that's the case? Why do men die younger than women everywhere, all the time? And someone in the back popped off, because women suck the life out of us. And after the laughing stopped, I said, you're absolutely right. And it's called, in theory, in evolutionary theory, pleiotropic effects. At the genetics level, a man who works himself half to death can amass resources, can attract a superior mate, so that he ends up with genetic superior, better adapted to the particular environment, children, than his competition, even if that competition lives 200 or 300 years old. So from the perspective of genetics and competition, it's actually more advantageous to, what's the old saying, live fast, die young. It's better to burn out than fade away. Old songs, old lyrics, and revealing a bit of a sort of evolutionary truth, perhaps. But it seems to explain why people actually do the things they do. you can, if you work hard, acquire superior mates, but there's a cost to that, to the individual. The advantage is genetic, and it looks like, given that this is the way actually men and women behave, that genetics is driving the behavioral train. It's the best explanation we've had so far for that universal idea that men die younger than women everywhere, other than just women are naturally superior to men, a position I've heard argued a couple of times. What about suicide? This is the best example of the necessity of thinking genetically. Someone said, well, the fact that someone commits suicide, if evolution was true, we would have evolved an aversion to suicide. We would have evolved an impossibility of suicide. That way, our genetics would keep living. Not so much. Remember, from the genetic perspective, in your extended family, your genetics are what must survive. We are evolved to privilege the survival of our genetics, even if they're in our siblings, even if they're in our cousins, even if they're in our parents and children. Parents will sacrifice for their children, sacrifice their lives for their children. Everybody knows that. But also, a little extended a little farther, if I commit suicide, let's say I'm a loser. Let's say I don't have it going on. I am just a drain on the family resources. If I commit suicide, I'm actually enhancing my genetic survival by allowing the resources that I am squandering to be given to my more adaptive, stronger, better situated siblings. Then I actually increase the chances of my own genetics surviving through them. The fact that we share genetics in a family means that my suicide might enhance my own genetic survival. But it's a question, again, level of analysis. It isn't my personal embodied genetics. It's my genetics as seen out in the extended family. So the cold reality, and it does feel cold, and people sort of get appalled by this, is that the reproductive potential and net cost to genetic kin, is the way the evolutionary psychologists pitch this, foster suicide in those elements of an extended family that frankly are a net drag on the resources. It's depressing, it's distasteful, it sort of runs counter to most of our sort of moral sensibilities, but it does explain the behavior. All right, back to sexual strategies. This is the phrase that most evolutionary psychologists use to try to understand the different ways that once you've survived, once you've established the basics for living, how then do you acquire a mate? You can't just survive. It's not survival of the fittest anymore. It's reproductive fitness. So you got to have survival, but then you've got to figure out how to get a mate and how to help your children survive to adulthood and their own mating potential. I think one of the most important innovations of evolutionary psychology is this. People ask, what does it mean to be a man? The evolutionary psychologist would say, you're not a successful man unless you're focused on the grandchildren, unless you're raising your children to be good parents, unless you're raising your children to be the kind of parents that will foster the survival of the grandchildren and beyond. That's the privileged priority in evolutionary psychology. In a way, it's a bedrock scientific theory that fosters the primacy of the family. Interesting parallel. In order to have a family, you have to go through a series of sexual strategies. Now, we used to sort of think mating is fairly simple. You find an appropriate partner, you hook up, and then you live happily ever after. Turns out it's a lot more complicated than that, and anybody that's been on the dating scene for more than a minute knows that this is true. Again, evolutionary psychology sort of reinforcing and explaining some common sense understandings of human nature, as it were. The first thing we understand in evolutionary psychology about sexual strategies is that they are never random. There is no random selective process. We always are motivated. Who we choose has meaning. We have preferences, adaptive preferences, that focus on both survival and reproduction, and they're not cultural. This is, again, part of the difficulty with evolutionary psychology, in that most people think, they're trained to want things. And this theory says, no, not at all. That we instinctively want certain things in a mate. We instinctively want certain things in terms of our ecology, in terms of the food we eat, the vistas we look at. That there's something even about beauty that is a hardwired, pre-adapted preference that if it doesn't control us directly in a determined way, it certainly influences us in a very powerful way. If we're going to select a mate, and that's the first strategy, we have to select one, we have to recognize that these universal adaptive preferences are the same in every culture in the world. How you wear your hair, what kind of jewelry you wear, what kind of clothes you wear, that varies. But the fundamental questions of mate preferences appear in the research to be universal. And they've evolved to adapt to a tribal community. Now, we're not in a tribal community, but we act as if we are around mate selection. We'll get to the specifics of this in just a few minutes. Now, once you've found one, that doesn't end the struggle. You have to attract the mate, male or female. And this, frankly, for men especially, is where the unrelenting, unforgiving competition comes in. Men are territorial, men are aggressive, and the research, even by the best cognitive behaviorist psychologists in the laboratory, have long since shown that there are gender differences here, that men are more territorial, that men are more aggressive, and everyone that's got their eyes open knows that this is true, that the genders aren't equal on many things. They're differences. I didn't say one is superior to the other. I said they're differences. And those differences are best explained, it seems to me, by the adaptive requirements of our differing biologies. So once you attract one, then you've got to keep them. Everyone that's dated for any length of time knows that there are people who attempt to seduce your partner away from you. There are people who do that. Maybe you're one of them. Keeping a mate involves jealousy, vigilance, sometimes violence. Men are more vigilant and violent than women. The intensity of jealousy emotion is significantly greater in men than women. All the scientific research suggests that that's true. Women aren't as overtly jealous as men are. And it looks like this comes down to one of the female's number one requirements. The thing women want most, it appears, are resources. Men, because that is the attribute that most likely assures genetic survival of her and her children. Men feel in a similar way that genetic survival is the key, but of course, if they're raising someone else's children, they're not genetically surviving. So this is, again, uncomfortable, and it doesn't seem fair, and it doesn't seem equal, but because of biology, a woman is less threatened by a man's affair than a man is threatened by his partner, a woman's affair. To the woman, a philandering man threatens mostly loss of resources, loss of intimacy, loss of some security. Those are bad things, and it's not to be dismissed as unimportant. It's critically important, obviously. But to a man, a philandering woman, a cheating woman, means genetic death. It is the only capital crime. It means that man's reactions to jealous-making situations are intensely motivated, are potentially quite violent. The example people come up in class all the time with is the difference between Kobe Bryant and O.J. Simpson. Now, I know there's some dispute, but let's go with the hypothetical that O.J. Simpson murdered his wife. He didn't just murder her. He butchered her in an act of almost unspeakable rage and violence. It makes no sense. You want to kill her, you just kill her. But no. The rage makes sense if you look at it as a genetic threat to his existence. Her cheating on him with the boyfriend enraged him to the point of butchery. But it doesn't excuse the behavior at all, but it explains the level of rage. The threat was catastrophic. The threat was genetic death. And so his reaction, made worse by the fact that he was an unstable, probably quite mentally ill man, of questionable character on top of that, makes that behavior at least understandable to some degree. Kobe Bryant, a couple years ago, Kobe Bryant got accused of some sexual infidelity and was actually taken to trial over it. His wife was there sitting next to him. She wasn't happy. She looked like she was quite angry, but she also had a diamond ring on her finger the size of a goose egg, it seemed to me. And the two different responses between Kobe Bryant's wife and O.J. Simpson, I think, highlight as a... We have to be careful. We can't extrapolate from single events entire populations. That's obvious. But it's a useful metaphor, perhaps, to describe the difference in intensity on the question of jealousy as it, between men and women, as a function of its effect on their genetic survival. So, if we can't keep a mate, we have to replace one. Marriage is universal. In the vast majority of cultures, marriage, monogamous marriage, is the most usual way. Now, there's statistics that show that polygamy is dominant in 83% of the cultures. Now, that's misleading because if you just add up the different cultures, that's true, but in terms of raw numbers of people, monogamous committed marriage between a man and a woman seems to be the overwhelming norm statistically all over the world. But also, divorce is common all over the world. Both of these things are true. And evolutionary psychology explains that there are times when it makes sense genetically to end a relationship. What if your partner isn't fertile? What if the man can't produce a child? What if the woman cannot? What if something better comes along that will better secure genetic survival? The fact that relationships tend to be so vulnerable has to be explained. And in many cases, it seems to me, there is no better explanation than genetic survival through the theory, through the lens of evolutionary psychology. We end relationships. Sometimes we cheat. Sometimes we're committed and monogamous. And in all of those cases, it's, I think, well explained by evolutionary theory with a focus on genetic survival. Now, there are other ways to explain it. There's no question about that. And all evolutionary psychology is doing is presenting an alternative theory. And I, as I said before, any one individual may not fit within the bounds of this theory. But if you read this material carefully, I think you'll find it explains a lot of human behavior. Whether it makes us comfortable or not doesn't argue against it. The fact that I may not like it, that it may violate moral tenets I was raised on, that isn't an argument against the theory. The question is, what does it do in the real world? Does it explain things better than other paradigms? Is it useful? That, to me, is the better standard. You don't get to say about any theory, it offends me, therefore it's not true. We have to get beyond that, certainly. So back to gender differences a little bit. Why is it that mothers tend to be more caring of their children than fathers are? Fathers are more distant. They don't seem to care as much as mothers. This seems like a problem. It seems like it's true, but it needs to be explained. And the answer that the evolutionary psychologists have come up with is the uncertainty of paternity. There's an old saying, mama's baby, papa's maybe. And that simply says that every woman knows who her children are. There's no doubt about that. So she gets to commit fully to their rearing. Her genetic survival depends on the success of her children, which she knows are her children. She was there when they were born. Father's not so much. Father's not so clear. Everybody, the standard joke about the redheaded stepchild. Fathers may want to hedge their bets. Fathers aren't as committed because they've never been as sure of their fatherhood. Again, don't know if it's a perfect explanation, don't know if it's true, but it seems to explain what we see on a daily basis in common human life. What about war? Sigmund Freud carried on a brief correspondence with Albert Einstein in the early 1930s. Einstein wrote to him and said, "Help me understand war. We need to be we need to stop all this fighting and killing. Both of them had lived through the First World War. They could see the Second World War coming by the early 30s, certainly. And so Freud wrote back and referenced, I think, the need for us to identify with each other. And absent that, we tend to act like tribes. And if we believe that our territory is threatened, if we believe that our tribal members are threatened by other tribal members, to us that threatens our genetic survival, and we will respond with all the power we have to survive. We now have shifted our identification to the nations, to the nation states. And the dynamic is the same. Patriotism is the same as tribalism in some ways. Now, we can criticize that and say that, you know, that there's too much of that and we all ought to be in this universal brotherhood of man. But the utopians that talk like that have some problems. They don't seem to understand the inherent, unrelenting, unforgiving competition that Malthus pointed out 200, 300 years ago, excuse me, that even if we could meet all of our day-to-day needs for clothing, food, and shelter, we would still be in competition with others for superior mates, for superior place. Not all places are the same. Not all vistas are equally as attractive. So there's no way to get around the human nature of intense competition. And therefore, there's no way to get around war, that we can mitigate it. We can understand its motivation. And here's the troubling part. The evolutionary psychologists have become clear that most wars are driven by the desire for sexual access, that most wars are wars of conquest, where at bottom, the unstated, unspoken, possibly even unconscious motivation for most of the men involved is access to women. It explains why in war, rape is so common, inevitable, in fact, dangerously so. But if you want to work toward peace, it's entirely possible that the only way to do that is, in fact, through strength. Because as long as human nature is what it is, the evolutionary psychologists are warning us that we are not going to discover a universal brotherhood of man anytime soon. We would have to, in fact, be a different species for that to happen. And genetically, that isn't going to happen for the next million years at least. So it's sobering. We don't like it. We wish there were solutions to this problem. But it's also possible that evolutionary psychology thinking might actually provide us the best way yet discovered for, if not mitigating, at least preventing the wars we can prevent. Utopianism seems a delusion, seems an illusion. And I have to say this, and this might disturb people, pacifists, people who believe that all war and aggression is bad, from the evolutionary psychology's perspective, they might be the losers. You might have a situation where, this is something that the great German philosopher Nietzsche pointed out, where a society that becomes weakened fosters peace and brotherly love as a moral value, not because it's a superior way to live, but because in open competition with others, they will lose. And so they attempt to foster a morality that favors them. In a way, it's a subterranean way to compete at their own level. And without degenerating into a political discussion any further, and I say these things simply because evolutionary psychology has provided us with some very interesting theories, just theories, that might provide us a way of thinking about not just genetic survival, but the way our tribes are now organized and what they occasionally, all too frequently perhaps, do to each other. We wouldn't be aggressive if it hadn't worked to foster our survival. One last point on that that makes some people quite uncomfortable. We can blame women for men's aggression and territoriality. I'm joking, kind of. What man was most sought after by our Cro-Magnon tribal female ancestors? The one that was aggressive, the one that was territorial, the one that could hunt and defend, the one who was big and strong and brave and had the will to survive in the face of great odds. those are the ones who were most sought after by the best females and their kin, frankly. So it turns out that women historically have absolutely needed territorial, aggressive men in order to survive during the time that they are incredibly vulnerable, late pregnancy, and rearing one, two, three, four, however many children they have. Women are incredibly vulnerable. So men that weren't territorial, aggressive, capable of defending, capable of hunting, capable of fighting off other bands of men who were attempting to take what was theirs, these men were not privileged. It is female preferences.